Good afternoon, everyone. House Education Finance Committee will come to order. And let's see, Representative Poston, you were here, I noticed, in your seat, and had you had a chance to review the minutes from the February 28th meeting?
Madam Chair, I have reviewed the minutes. They look fine, so I'd like to move to approve them.
All right. Motion has been moved to adopt the minutes from February 28th. Oh, there is, yes. It's not Ron Mariani. You are correct. We will make corrections so that Representative Mariani's name is accurately spelled. Thank you. Good catch. Thank you very much. All right. So Representative Poston moves adoption of the minutes with corrections to Representative Mariani's name, and our apologies to Representative Mariani. Any other questions or notations? All right, seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Thank you very much, Representative Poston and Mars. Thank you very much, Mr. Ostrandy. All right, so today we are going to do our overview of the forecast. Obviously, the budget forecast was released yesterday, and we wanted to give our fiscal analysts time to comb through all of the explanation and notes behind that and around that. So we will have presentations both from nonpartisan staff today as well as the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. So with that, if there's no other comments, and Representative Mariani, good to see you. And
I'm trying to understand I have a new name.
Hey, Ron.
Looking forward to you.
You can be whoever you want to be today. So, all right.
Thank you.
And with that, we are going to go ahead and turn to our nonpartisan staff. So we have Ms. Emily Agins, our fiscal analyst, and Mr. Strom from Pulse Research. And whoever would like to kick off, why don't you go ahead and tell us what charts you want us to look at, and we will follow along.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. If you would get the spreadsheet or the tracking sheet out and pull that in front of you. And then there's also a poverty concentration table and chart that I think is interesting, so I'll refer to that at one point too. And I'm sure you're all very familiar with the tracking sheet, and so I'm going to try to go sort of quickly just to make some references to the changes that appeared because of the February forecast. But please stop me at any point if I'm talking too quickly or if something doesn't make sense that I'm saying. So in the column that I'd like everyone to sort of focus on is sort of right in the middle, and it says it's the difference between the February and EOS, which is end of session, for 2018-19. And so if there, and what I did was I only put numbers in there that are due to programs that are forecasted programs. So there is a little bit of shifting that happens. For example, we had a few programs that were, they had money appropriated, but then they were allowed to spend the money over 3 years, so where it crossed biennium lines. So you would have seen a number show up in there, but it would have been just because they didn't spend all of the money in the prior biennium, and then it showed up in the 18-19 biennium. So if I have any, like, number hawks out there who are really looking, you won't see those numbers in there because I just wanted to focus on the forecast changes. But I'm happy to get into any of those numbers as well. So the first one that we're going to look at is the compensatory and the general education numbers. So this is line 21, and then I stuck compensatory in right above it just to kind of pull it out of that gen ed number. The compensatory number, I don't know if you heard much of this with forecast updates, but this one, I don't have a number for the difference between the end of session, but it mostly plays into this $11 million reduction in the general education base number. The spending for compensatory showed a downward trend in this forecast, and it was about $19 million. And that's due to an update in data that's related to the measure of poverty concentration. So this you can look at the poverty concentration table that was included. And you can see that since fiscal year 2009, it's been on a pretty major upward trend. And then it sort of plateaus in 14 and kind of comes down. And in 18, you can see that this is where the difference happened between the November forecast and the February forecast. I'm sorry, the actual two. But so from 18 to 21, it goes down. And so this is the reason for the lower anticipated amounts of spending for compensatory. And so because the trend continues downward, the lower spending will be seen in 2020 and 2021 as well. So that trend will go into the tails. So the overall net decrease in the gen ed number is mostly a result of the compensatory funding reduction. There was a small increase in funding for the basic formula. That amount was about $7 million, and we see that often, and that's a result primarily of the increase in refining of that of the pupil data counts that happen. I'm going to go next to the non-public pupil aids for education aid and transportation aid. Those are on lines 29 and 30. Here there was a reduction of $1.9 million and $1.1 million. And, you know, there are a couple of possible explanations for these. There are a general decline in the rate of the number of students attending non-public schools. So that and participation just on the part of non-public schools is a reason for the non-public pupil education aid number going down. For the transportation aid, that is, the formula is based on the average statewide cost for transportation and the number of the non-public school students who are transported. So, again, like if there are fewer number of non-public students being transported, that number goes down, of course. The next number I want you to look at is on page 2. This is the literacy incentive aid. It's on line 56. And if anyone was paying attention to the November forecast, this went down then as well, but I just wanted to point it out. So there's a decrease of just under $2.4 million for 18 and 19, and then it flattens out a little bit more for the tails. No, it doesn't. It goes up, excuse me, it goes up to about $4.3 million in a reduction in the tails. And this program, this is the one that's projected. It uses a five-year average of the MCAs, the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments, for the reading proficiency scores. So the actual proficiency scores for fiscal year 2017, they were lower than the previous estimate. So that reduces expenditures in this area for this program. Now, if you'll look at line 73, this is tribal contract schools. This number, again, it's driven primarily by the number of students who attend tribal contract schools. So the number, again, the participation is likely just down. There is a portion of it that there's a federal share of the aid. But typically that federal share remains steady or increases, so it's more likely that participation is just down in that area as well. Now we'll talk about special ed, and that is on page 3. On line 95, this is the biggest portion of the special ed spending. And again, for the November forecast, there was an increase of just over $100 million. So for the February forecast, that increase in spending has been revised downward. So now the increase is just over $74 million. The special education formula, as you know, is very complicated. So I am in no way an expert in this, and we can certainly talk more about it at another time. And also the agency is a really good resource. So I'm just going to give you kind of the simplified version. So the trend in the overall increase of spending for special ed is based on the need for an increased need for special education services and along with the increased cost of providing those services. Now, the reason for the decrease from the November forecast to the February forecast, part of the way of calculating how much money is going to be spent here is it's a growth rate that's averaged over years. So there was a calculated growth rate of 5.2% that was used for the November forecast. And that growth rate was reduced to 4.9%. And it's the growth rate of the need and everything from the years of 2017 to 2021. So I'm going to stop there on the special ed, but we can certainly talk more about it. And I think there are some other documents in or printouts in here related to special ed. So the next item, school lunch. I just wanted to point this out, too, on line 116. On line 116. So there's a reduction here of about $1.4 million. Again, this is a result that is likely because of just fewer lunches served and fewer reduced lunch students. So because we pay for free and reduced lunch, and so, but the amount that we pay for the free lunch, it's not, we pay the same amount for free lunch as we do for the fully paid lunches. So that doesn't matter as much. So the more likely explanation is that there are fewer lunches served overall. So ECFE is on page 4. This is on line 135. And again, it's a pretty small portion of the overall amount that's appropriated for ECFE, but I just wanted to point it out. It's about $1.7 million reduction. And this is a result so that there are fewer kids estimated as part of the school's count of all four-year-old students. They use a statewide growth factor for this, and the actual count has been flatter than the growth rate that has been used in the past. So so we see a little bit of a reduction there. On the same page, adult basic education aid is on line 158, and there's a reduction here of just under $2.7 million. Similar to the November forecast, there was a reduction here as well. And it's a small portion, again, of the entire appropriation that we have for ABE. But one of the determinants of the amount of aid that's used are contact hours. So they came in lower than previously projected. So this causes a bit of a downward adjustment over the entire forecast period for ABE. And Madam Chair, I think that's everything that I wanted to talk about for the tracking. All right. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. So just so I understand this literacy incentive aid, I guess that's an incentive aid. So we actually pay districts more the more kids they have that are reading well.
Right. Yeah. Correct. Let me turn to Mr. Strom. He can maybe give you more.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, we're going to talk specifically about literacy aid in just a few minutes.
Okay.
Any other questions just on the tracking sheet for Ms. Adrians? All right, and we can always come back to it if you have questions that occur to you as we go along. All right. Mr. Strom, are you up next?
Madam Chair, members. The next two documents to turn to, there's a one-page description of the literacy aid program in your packet, and then a printout, and I'd like to mainly work off the printout for you. The one-page sheet describes the literacy aid program, and as Representative Thiessen just mentioned, this is an unusual formula compared to many of our formulas because it essentially is one that pays school districts additional money depending on how well their kids are doing. There's two halves to the formula, and if you look at the printout, you can see the two halves. Roughly $40-some million a year, $46 million or thereabouts per year is spent on this, and about half the money is distributed on the basis of proficiency or how well students are reading at the third grade level, and the other half of the money is spent on how much growth the school site is seeing between its third and fourth grade students. So the $46 million or so is split into those two categories. And what the printout, if you turn to the printout now, the maximum amount of the formula is essentially $530 per enrollee that's taking the test for each of these two categories. So if you had 100% proficiency and 100% growth, you'd see those numbers. How the printout is organized, there's the third grade student count followed by the proficiency revenue per third-grade student that's listed for fiscal years 16, 17, and 18. So if we just take the top district as an example, for the Aiken School District, you can see they're reporting a total of 81 third-grade students. And I should add, by the way, this is one of these formulas that's actually calculated at the site level, not at the district level. So the department's data for this is available at each site. You'll notice a whole bunch of zeros on the printout for third-grade students, and the department is required to shield the data for those that have very small numbers so that there can't be any personally identifiable data. So if you see a school district like the third one listed, Hill City, showing third-grade students of zero, it's not that they're really zero, it's that that information is shielded from us so we don't know the number that we're successful because it's such a relatively small number. But if you go back to the first district listed, Aiken, you can see in 16 there were 81 third-grade students enrolled. The proficiency revenue per student was $269 per student. So that essentially calculated the percent of students that were proficient that's scored at that level or above, and that times the formula amount gave them $269. You can see in the next year that the number of third grade students reported taking the test grew a bit to 92, and the proficiency revenue fell a little bit to $257 per third grade student. And then same for fiscal year 18, another little growth in Aiken in that number of third grade students showing up in the enrollment category there, and the proficiency revenue at about $250 per student. Then the next group of columns does the same thing, but for growth between third and fourth. So the department calculates the essentially the adequate or above growth rates between third and fourth grade, and the reward formula, as it were, then provides the $530 per student times the percentage that are reaching those growth levels. And you can see on the growth levels for 16, the district had $374 per pupil, in the 17, $353, and then in 18, $361 per pupil. So I've tried to aggregate up to the district level here all of the individual sites within the school district. That won't be the total student enrollment, because if any of those students are at a site that's masked essentially, then we're not getting a count or a proficiency or growth percentage for that site. So same way to calculate for Minneapolis, then, out of the sites that are reportable, 2,370 students in 16, and you can read across in the same way and see the trend over the last three years on both the proficiency that is at that level for third graders that the state has set, or growth between third and fourth grade in those last six columns. So, Madam Chair, that's a quick discussion of the literacy aid and literacy incentive aid program.
Thank you, Mr. Schramm. Just a quick question for you. I hadn't had a chance to review those until just now. And did you notice any trends with this? Is it more of a drop of the third grade proficiency, or more of a drop of the fourth grade growth measurement, or is that kind of equally split that resulted in slightly less literacy aid being projected in the forecast?
Madam Chair, folks from the department may have a better sense of that than me. I'm just not sure what's caused the trend. I've heard some talk about the proficiency standard being a little less met by students, but I haven't done any analytical work to show if that's the case or not.
All right. Thank you. And Representative Erickson, I'll put your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You asked my question. We'll wait to hear from the department.
All right. Representative Teason?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I understand this. So why do you get 269 instead of 530?
Madam Chair, Representative Teason, it takes the percent that are proficient times that $530, essentially. So in Aiken's case, what would that be? About 47 students maybe were proficient or above out of the 81. So you take that ratio times the $530 to get the amount per student. So there's 81 third grade students. The number that are proficient that number over 81 times 530 gives you 269. So we could back into that real quick here.
No, I get that. Oh, okay, that's fine. I get the gist.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could just make a couple of other comments regarding Representative Thiessen's initial question. This is one of the few formulas that essentially rewards performance, and there was a great deal of discussion when this formula passed whether that was the right way to go or not, and perhaps some of the members that were here then would like to speak to that. It was a program that was Senator Jen Olson was the primary advocate for this program, but the idea was that it was specifically designed to reward success, which is different than most of our other funding or programs.
Representative Thiessen.
Have we looked at whether it's had an impact of increasing proficiency?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I have not. The you know, one thing to keep in mind, the general education revenue, as if you look at the front of Ms. Adrian's spreadsheet, shows about $7 billion a year being spent on that, and the proficiency revenue is about $45 million a year. So you're talking about a very small, relatively small amount of money around the edges. I'm not sure. I haven't heard much from school folks whether they view it as an incentive that helps them or not. So I just don't have any information on that front.
And Mr. Strom, along those lines, I'm trying to recall, are schools required to spend the literacy aid on literacy programs?
I don't believe so, Madam Chair. I think that's it's a general fund unreserved aid, I believe. So.
Thank you. Representative Krishna.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Strong. Just real quick, you mentioned local reporting, so the schools report themselves. Is that correct, or is there an oversight? And what's the objective measures? How and maybe this is for the department, too. I'm just curious how we're getting to these numbers locally.
Madam Chair, Representative Krishna, Mr. Uni is coming to give you a better description of this, but essentially it's related to the assessment data. It's all based on the third and fourth grade MCA assessment, yes. So it's reported under that system. And then, as Ms. Adrian's mentioned, there's a three-year average of the data over time to keep the formula relatively more stable so that a one-year change wouldn't have a huge effect. So the department actually has to track a whole number of years in order to make each year's calculation. But it's based on all of the assessment data that's reported by the district, and MDE calculates that for them. So it's not separately submitted data that's used for the calculation.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Uni is here, so if you'd like to add to this conversation, please do.
Madam Chair, members, I don't have anything to add to the data that's used that Mr. Strom gave there, but to the prior question around what the required use of the funding is, that districts have to make a literacy plan, but then the funding goes into the general fund. So the restrictions aren't really there after that.
Thank you. We appreciate that clarification. You might want to stay close, Mr. Amy.
I might have to phone a friend, Madam Chair.
More questions along the way. All right. Any other questions at this moment? If not, we'll keep moving on. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, I think that's about it on the literacy aid discussion, unless members have other questions. Again, if you were to multiply these columns all out and get to the totals, they wouldn't quite match the state totals because of the cells that are masked for the sites that are too small to show up.
Thank you. Representative Krishna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry for Mr. Rooney, I'm wondering if you left already, but the districts that are doing well, are they sharing their best practices with the districts that are not?
Mr. Ernie, do you need the question repeated?
No, I have caught it, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Krishna, there's a report that we have that may could be a little bit more useful. And it's strategies for high-growth schools, so there may be some shared in there. Schools do meet up with each other in different conferences, and there are discussions like the Superintendent's Conference, other conferences at MDE held by stakeholder groups where they do share best practices with one another, so I'm sure that is occurring. But I'm not familiar off the top of my head. Yeah. So Mr. Keith is referring to our literacy specialist who does review the plans and issues guidance like we do with many other issue areas. But in terms of, a big collaboration, that's mostly through that guidance and then just through conversations via conferences and networking.
Representative Grisham? Thank you, Mr. Rooney. All right, so I think we'll go ahead and move on to your next. Oh, that's it? Oh, okay. All right, and that was basically it on the forecast. We are going to have the department come down and talk about special ed and other things. Yes, and the ESSA Title I funds as well. So if there's no other questions for nonpartisan right now, I guess we'll go ahead and move to that. So Mr. Keith and Dr. Melcher, were you here as a resource or? Thank you. I think we will probably have some questions on that, but we'll go ahead with Mr. Keith and Mr. Uni at this time.
Madam Chair, I'm Greg Keith. I'm Chief Academic Officer at the Minnesota Department of Education.
Welcome back, Mr. Keith.
With me program staff who won't actually present but will be here to answer questions.
Madam Chair, John Morris with the Minnesota Department of Education.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming back today.
Mr. Morris is our director of our student support division, which is our federal programs division. So if you do have really in the weeds questions, I'm going to turn to John to rescue me. You have the PowerPoint in front of you, and what we prepared today was a PowerPoint speaking to some of the federal program funding streams under ESSA and some of the programs and requirements that accompany those. Specifically, we understood the request to be for some information about the new Title IV Part A program under ESSA. And so specifically, we'll have a few slides on that. I'm not going to hit everything in the PowerPoint. I know that you can read the information. So I'm going to limit my comments to further explanation of some of the terminology or some of the observations about some of the information that's presented rather than going through every single bullet on the PowerPoint. But if there's something that I don't necessarily speak to that there are questions about, we would welcome your questions specifically on those. So we're going to speak primarily about three federal programs, Titles I, Title II, and Titles I, II, and III. These are by far the largest programs under the ESSA, Every Student Succeeds Act. So I'm going to mainly focus on Titles I, II, and III. Before I start talking about Titles I, II, and III, I do want to hit on two areas which are really just broad requirements that apply across all of the title programs. These four items are four requirements that districts must adhere to as they plan and as they expend resources. I'm not going to speak to all four of these, but I'm going to limit my comments to the first one, the supplement, not supplant, because this is one that we often work with districts on. And the general talking point here is that for these programs that we're talking about, districts and schools can't use these funds to fund things that they either would already do or have to do under state law. These funds have to be expended to supplement what's already in existence and what they already must do. So they can't, for example, fund special education teachers with this in order to comply with state law. It has to be above and beyond what's required and what they're funded with through state funding sources and state requirements. So with the coming of ESSA, there was a new requirement, and I'm on slide number four now. And really, there was a broad requirement in No Child Left Behind, but ESSA kind of clarifies and also kind of raises the bar around the fact that whatever schools and districts are spending title funds on, they have to have an evidence base behind that strategy. So they can't just choose something. They have to be implementing things that have been proven to be successful or to have an impact on teaching and learning. And so as you look at this, you're going to see, this is the actual language from ESSA. There's really four tiers of evidence-based setup. Strong evidence, moderate evidence, and then promising evidence. And so these are the highest three tiers. So for those, there has to be some sort of well-designed and implemented study that has demonstrated that this practice does indeed positively impact student learning or teaching. For most programs, they can also, there's a fourth tier of evidence, which you see, that it demonstrates a rationale. So there's some sort of rationale based on research or based on evaluation that what they're proposing to implement could have an impact on, a positive impact on student learning and teaching, but there's not necessarily a well-designed research study backing this up. But there's enough information that you could provide a rationale. If they implement something under that fourth tier, then they have to study what they're implementing. They have to continuously study and track whether or not it is indeed having that positive impact. I'll note there's one exception for school improvement activities. That fourth tier, that demonstrating a rationale, is unavailable. They have to, for school improvement, they have to implement at least one strategy that has the appropriate evidence base.
All right. And Mr. Keith, Representative Mariani had a question.
Yeah, I'm sure very quickly because I don't want to break the rhythm here, but is that a new standard in the that was established under the new ESEA reauthorization?
It's, Mr. Keith.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, Representative, it's a it's an expanded standard. There was a standard in No Child Left Behind that there had to be a research base behind a scientifically researched base behind what they're implementing. Under ESSA, this is a lot. They're changing from a research base to an evidence base, and it's a lot more clear and a lot more rigorous. So I wouldn't say it's new as much as different and a higher standard.
All right. Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Keith.
Thank you. So I'm going to speak for just a second about Title I Part A, which is primarily thought of as supporting low-income students or students living in poverty. And I'm going to pause to point out one thing here. Through these funding streams that we're talking about, just to put this in perspective, really when you look at a school or a district's budget, these federal funds that we're talking about today are generally about 5% of their overall revenue. So in the grander scheme of things, these are not huge funding pots for schools and districts. So just kind of giving you a little bit of perspective there. You can see there that our state award was approximately $156 million. And this money flows to the state, through formula grants to districts who then flow it to schools. So this money actually primarily goes to schools. And it flows from the state to districts through a couple of different formulas, but it's primarily based on the number of students in poverty in any given district and on the concentration of poverty in any given district. So there's really kind of four formulas through which this flows to districts, but collectively those formulas are based on number of students in poverty and concentration of poverty. You can read the content in the slides for yourself, so I'm gonna just make a couple of elaborations and a couple of points. These funds can be spent on a wide variety of things by schools, as long as what they are spending the money on, number one, is tied back to a needs assessment that must be conducted annually. So it's fulfilling some need that was emerged from a needs assessment in their planning process. And number two, serves these underserved populations. In shorthand, we generally talk about the underserved populations served by Title I being low-income students, but they can also be homeless students, neglected students, delinquent students, students in foster care. So it's a little broader than students in poverty, but generally you'll hear districts and schools talk about poor kids, kids in poverty, kids on free and reduced price lunch. You often have heard me talk about the work of the regional centers, and you've heard me talk about that we use federal funds to fund our school improvement work in the regional centers. This is where that money comes from. 7% of the state's Title I Part A allocation is directed to the state level in order to support school improvement projects and school improvement grants around the state. So when you hear me talk about the federal money for the regional centers, the school improvement money, it's 7% of this allocation that I'm talking about. I want to point out one thing here. We don't see a lot of schools spend – we primarily see schools spend this on family engagement activities and frequently on remediation types of activities. Given ESSA, there was a lot more clarity and a lot more encouragement for districts and schools to spend this money not just on remediation but on expanding access for these kids. And so there was an increased emphasis on encouraging schools to spend this on career and technology education programs, rigorous courses for students, early learning programs as well have always been allowable here. But under ESSA, there was an increased emphasis on encouraging schools and districts to spend their money in those areas. More preventive and more expanding access than remediation.
Representative Peterson had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on that particular subject, can you use those funds to maybe develop, I guess, sort of a matrix, if you will, to determine what areas the school should be focused on?
We do. Excuse me. I always forget. Madam Chair, Representative, we do provide guidance to districts, and one of the things that we're currently doing in light of ESSA and in light of changing priorities at the state is we're taking a look at the guidance in terms of does our guidance in any intended or unintended way influence what schools and districts might spend their money on? I hope that answers your question.
Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair, well, it's just to help them develop, I guess, to help them compile information so that they know where they need to focus on for that improvement area.
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative, one of the projects that we're doing is we're putting together a list of evidence-based practices. I mentioned the requirements around evidence-based. And we're really looking to that list of non-exhaustive list of evidence-based practices linked to needs that a practice would address. We're really looking to that to fulfill that need that you're talking about. And there was the question about third grade best practices. I think that also speaks to that inquiry.
Thank you.
There are two terms on slide number five that I do want to point out. There's two different program models at the school level that you might hear schools and districts throw around. They can, with their Title I funds, a school can implement either what's called a targeted assistance program or a school-wide program. If a school implements a targeted assistance program, then they're using their funds only to serve underserved kids, so to provide direct services only to underserved kids. If a school has greater than 40% students on free and reduced price lunch or economically disadvantaged students, then they can choose to do a school-wide program, which means that they can implement programs with their Title I funds at the school level. So students who aren't actually underserved or economically disadvantaged could benefit from those programs since it's implemented at a school-wide level.
Mr. Keith, do you know generally how schools in Minnesota are approaching this? Are they taking the school-wide approach if they have higher than 40% populations of students who would qualify for Title I?
Madam Chair, generally they will, and I'll turn to John to see if he has any further elaboration there.
Yes, that's correct. Most of the schools that reach that 40% poverty threshold do decide to move to the school-wide program. Because of the limited resources that Title I provides, the school-wide approach allows for more students to potentially benefit from the program than with the targeted assistance model.
All right. Thank you. Hands going up, Representative Dabney.
One brief question, Madam Chair. Thank you. I see that Title I funds must be used for private schools. Are there private schools that are taking Title I funds and implementing school-wide initiatives, or are they using them for more targeted initiatives?
Mr. Morris?
Madam Chairman, Representative, when we're working with the private schools, non-public equitable share, those programs need to be targeted assistance. That directive comes from the federal level.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Keith, if 7% of the state allocation is for supporting school improvement activities, this is flowing to the regional centers, correct?
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative, the regional centers as well as the school improvement teams in Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Oh, that's right. Stand corrected. So that would be about $11 million, Mr. Keith?
Mr. Keith?
It's actually just a little bit less than that.
But about.
About, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So have you ever figured out, or I guess we could do this, how many students are actually served through these school improvement activities so that we could see how that plays out, so to speak? I don't know how many students are actually served through your regional centers. Have we ever had a report on that?
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative. We have not. That would be something that we could pretty easily do. Would like to encourage you, as you look at those numbers, to consider that with the identifications under ESSA in August, the number of schools served by the regional centers will rise. So while we so you see the 7% and you see that amount, we're still serving the previous focus priority schools, so
yes.
It may be a more accurate count to think about that in August when we actually identify schools under ESSA, but that could be something that we could provide.
I'll wait till August. I know you have a lot of data coming in August, so I'll wait. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I think we've got questions done for now, so please proceed.
So this next slide just gives you an idea of what's the general size of allocations and how many districts in general fall into the different levels of allocation size. And, of course, you could probably know that the two districts up at the top are St. Paul and Minneapolis. But this just kind of gives you an idea of how many districts are getting how much money. Yesterday when we presented some of this information, there was a question about the 19 districts that do not generate an award. And when we went back and started gathering some data for an inquiry yesterday, from yesterday's hearing in the Senate, those 19 districts are primarily charter schools. So we keep referring to districts. The federal government actually uses the terminology LEAs, which is districts and charters. Predominantly, those are charter schools who were generating an award of under $1,000. So given the requirements from the feds and given the process, many of them just did not feel like they had the capacity to fulfill that request for that amount of resources. So wanted to share with you just some high-level spending information. When we look at the Title I Part A spending, you see very quickly that 91% of this is basically going to human capital in the schools, so to salaries and to benefits. And those positions are generally reading intervention teachers, math intervention teachers, reading teachers, math teachers, counselors, other sorts of student support, service providers, but primarily they're reading, math, and student support positions. Done, anything? So I'm going to move to Title II. Title II, generally speaking, are federal funds that support teacher effectiveness. And while I say that, I'm going to have a big footnote in just a second to that. But generally, these funds are intended to support teacher effectiveness. This is a funding stream that's had quite a bit of discussion at the federal level. During their budgeting process, you may or may not be following, but this is one that has not shown up in some budget proposals at the federal level. So this is one that we're watching pretty closely because we definitely need our $28 million state allocation, which was our allocation in 2017. Again, this is distributed to districts based on students, but especially students who are living in poverty. And districts can use this money primarily to support teacher effectiveness, but they can also use it to support things like recruitment efforts, retention efforts. They can use this money to build teacher pipelines, to diversify their teaching workforce. So it doesn't have to just be existing teachers within the district. They can also use it to recruit and retain and train new teachers. So here's the big footnote. They can also use this money for class size reduction, which is not necessarily teacher effectiveness. And we do find that a lot of these funds are expended for class size reduction. At the state level, we use 4% of these. States use 4% of this money for state-level activities. So in our particular case, we primarily use that 4% in three different areas. We use it to support some of our academic standards work with schools and districts. We use it for some – you've probably heard Bobby Burnham talk about her early learning leadership series. We use it some of it to fund some of that. But primarily, we use it to support the implementation of two state initiatives, the QCOP program and teacher development and evaluation supports for schools and districts. So that's where the bulk of the state resources go. We also use 3% of this, the state allocation, to support state principal leadership support activities or school leadership support activities. This is something that's new under ESSA. And we use this to fund three positions in the regional centers and one position in the metro who are principal coaches and principal professional developers. They also provide support in terms of providing instructional feedback to principal supervisors. So moving forward, as with Title I, this slide just gives you an idea of how much money districts are receiving and how many districts are receiving some of the different windows of grant amounts. Again, you see the two districts of Minneapolis and St. Paul at the top, and then you can look further down. And then there's a similar caveat around charter schools and districts that have declined this award. You're going to begin to see a trend here in terms of what schools and districts spend this money on. And they spend about 85% of this on staffing and on benefits for staff. Primarily, these would be instructional coaches. These would be professional developers. These would be professional development coordinators. But a pretty common position that we see funded with Title II is instructional coaches and mentors. And then, of course, I'm going to reiterate the class size reduction ability here. And just remind you that a lot of districts spend this money on classroom teachers to reduce class size.
Representative Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Keith, these are locally decided issues, though, are they not, as to how they spend?
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. We do provide program guidance, and we do review needs assessment results and applications and approve those. But districts have a lot of leeway in terms of how they can spend it as long as it addresses a need. So Title III funds.
Sorry, one more question. Representative Mariani.
So, Madam Chair, so I get it that the salary raises are going to include all the strategies, including class size reduction strategies. Do you have a breakout of what the classroom reduction numbers would be?
Mr. Morris?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, we do not at this point, because with the UFAR system, the licensed staff would all be reported together. And so if it's a licensed staff person in the classroom or a licensed staff person as a mentor or an instructional coach, we wouldn't see that differentiation in that reporting.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Okay. I think we can keep going.
So the final one I'm going to speak to before we get to the others in the Title IV, Part A, is Title III. These are funds specific to supporting English learners with a small slice set aside specific to immigrant programs. Our state award was about $9.5 million. And, again, you're going to see a similar distribution model based on numbers of students. And districts use this money in any number of ways to supplement and support their English learners. So this is, a fairly broad program in terms of what they can spend the money on based on their assessed local needs. On this one, I'm going to pause and just talk about how some of the requirements around eligibility, if you will, because it's a little bit different from Title I and Title II. In that an LEA, a district, has to generate $10,000 or more before they can actually receive an individual award. This title is unique because if they don't generate $10,000, then they can form a consortium with other districts in order to receive and apply for these funds and share a plan and implement programs under this. So this one, that piece is a little unique to this one. Title III versus Titles I and Title II. But again, you can see the information that gives you some idea of how much money districts are receiving, of course, with Minneapolis and St. Paul there at the top. And so this just gives you a breakdown, a general idea how much money is flowing out to how many different types of districts. Again, you're going to see about 85% of this is supporting salaries, and this is primarily EL program coordinators, but primarily EL teachers or family liaisons and to a smaller degree positions like that. So those are the big three federal title programs under ESSA for which schools and districts receive funds. There's a number of smaller programs, and you can see those listed on slide. Wow, this print is small. Slide 14. I am going to talk just a little bit about Title IV Part A. That was requested in the request for us to visit with you today. But you can see that the other title programs primarily are designed to serve migrant students, delinquent students, and to provide some aid to especially small or poor rural schools and districts. So the Title IV Part A is a new program under ESSA. This was not in existence under No Child Left Behind. And I'm going to pause to just mention an item of interest. Many of you may have heard talk of new opportunities under ESSA to provide a well-rounded education. And as we were engaging in our ESSA work, there were many advocacy groups, especially at the national level, who were pointing to this Title IV Part A program in terms of providing districts and schools new opportunities to provide a well-rounded education. So to provide PE programs, expand art programs, additional music teachers, more counselors, more CTE programs, and definitely this pot of money is designed to support that. And this was one of the priorities in ESSA, and this was one of the specific strategies in ESSA to support states and districts and schools in terms of providing a well-rounded education. With that context built, there were a couple of disappointing items in relation to Title IV Part A for districts and advocates and states. One is just the overall size of this program. When you compare it with the EL and with the Title I and with the Title II, this is only about a $4 million program. So our state allocation was only $4.3 million. And as I note there, it's not necessarily one-time funding, but there is no future allocation for this money. So we're not even sure if we're going to receive more Title IV Part A money in the future. Minnesota chose to distribute this money through a competitive grant process. States were given the option of either doing competitive grants or formula grants to districts. And when we did the math and looked at the requirements around doing it through a formula grant, what districts would be getting was so nominal that we felt like it would have a very limited impact. So Minnesota and stakeholders decided that we were going to distribute this money through a competitive grant process. And you can see some of the details of the competitive grant process there. Two things I want to point out is that via the federal law, we do prioritize districts or charter schools with low-income or consortia of districts with concentrations of low-income students. So there's preferential treatment to those applications. And then we do have to distribute funds in a geographically diverse manner. So we can't concentrate all our grants in greater Minnesota or the metro or the suburban areas. We do have to have a geographically diverse set of grantees.
Mr. Keith, Representative Mariani had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do apologize. I was busy chatting about another charge, and so I probably missed this on this part. So very quickly, two questions. One is this student support academic research, is this a new thing within that had not existed before prior in the ESEA prior, right?
Mr. Keith or Mr. Morris?
Madam Chair, Representative, this is new. Was new with the reauthorization.
I thought so. And Madam Chair, and then and I apologize here, the one-time funding, what does that mean again?
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative, that means there was an allocation made to the state, but there are no future allocations, not to say that there could not be future allocations. Okay. So we are unclear if we will receive a future allocation, and if so, how much it would be.
Thank you. You said that. I wasn't paying close enough attention. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Keith, maybe, I don't want to jump ahead if you're getting to that. Oh, you are talking about how many schools got grants. Is that in the next page? All right, I'll let you continue. Oh, wait. Representative Erickson had a question. I apologize.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Keith, will the breakdown of the title spending show up on a school district budget or in the report card or both, or don't we know?
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative, it will show up on the report card.
Okay. Thank you. And that's for all the title, Madam Chair.
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
And so finally, with the Title IV Part A, you can see on slide 16 what some of our state-selected priorities were, and many of those will likely sound familiar to you in terms of equity and increasing equitable access. So these were some of the items where we provided guidance to grantees or applicants, rather, I should say. Also provided when we outlined the program, we encouraged them to implement programs or propose programs that met these different criteria that you see in that first bullet point or reinforce those state priorities. You can see in that second bullet the number of grantees. These three bucket areas that you see there are federal bucket areas. So states were required to use Title IV Part A funds in each of these three different areas, and there were required proportions at which we had to extend these. So grantees in Minnesota chose to apply in one of these three different areas, and then as we selected applicants to fund, we actually had to ensure that we were meeting the requirements in the federal law around a certain amount going to support well-rounded education, a certain amount to support safe and healthy schools and students, and then a certain amount to technology that supports personalized learning. So you can see the number of grantees that we have there. Title IV Part A does allow for a 5% state allocation to support well-rounded education, and we are using that fund, that money to support districts. So we articulate it as providing supports for districts to support a well-rounded education in their World Fest workforce plans. So we actually have one FTE that we have at the agency whose specific role is supporting districts in terms of implementing a well-rounded education for students through their World Fest workforce planning.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So are there reporting, are people reporting back on these grants about whether they actually do any good?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, there is a there is an end of grant report that is required.
And Mr. Keith, so because this is one time money, is that full time employee just here until the money runs out and then we may not have them, or were they moved from another area?
Madam Chair, we're hopeful and we're hopeful that we will continue to receive an allocation here. I believe that there's a lot of advocacy at the federal level for the opportunities that this particular program creates. So we're approaching it from a best case scenario. Our contingency plan is around looking at some of the school improvement work and folding it into the school improvement work should this program not be funded in the future.
All right, thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Keith, on this final page of the PowerPoint, the Minnesota priorities for these Title IV Part A grants, innovation, equity, and equitable access, access to rigorous academic standards, et cetera. Will well-rounded education include career and technical?
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that was one of the specific points that they could fund with that well-rounded. In fact, districts were encouraged to expand access to rigorous experiences for students, specifically around well-rounded IB, AP, PSEO, dual enrollment. So those were some of the specific examples and some of the specific areas that we were encouraging districts to explore in their applications.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you. But when I'm saying career and technical, I'm thinking more in terms of the old vocational. How about in that area? Is that included?
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that is included.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the access to rigorous academic standards, I've heard concerns from rural districts about the challenges of their participating in the standards review process, covering subs, finding subs, covering subs, transportation costs, hotel, food, lodging, all of that. And I expect that won't change as the department moves through other disciplines. Is this money available to support the review process, or is it only available for the implementation process?
Mr. Keith?
Madam Chair, Representative, we could use some of our state activities money to support that. We currently fund support for the standards review process, mileage, and substitute costs out of the department's general fund allocation. So we have budgeted support for that. In fact, in our currently we're reviewing ART standards, and I will just observe that we have a higher proportion of representation from Greater Minnesota than I also. So at the ground level, I've been more aware of the PE and arts just by when I took this position. And we definitely have a greater proportion of Greater Minnesota represented in the art standards review process than we did in the PE process.
Interesting. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Keith. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair,
Mr. Keith,
one more thing. And that being said, I acknowledge the issues that you brought are real issues for participation in the process, especially the substitute teacher issue, more than the mileage and funding subs. The bigger issue is finding subs, and that's in many, many, many different facets of our work.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you.
I think that's it for your presentation, gentlemen. There is information in our packets on special education and more as a resource. I didn't know if members have questions. I do have a couple of questions. So if Dr. Melcher would be willing to come down, and maybe my questions will spark others. I don't know. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Tom Melcher with the Department of Education.
All right. Thank you very much for being here, Dr. Melcher, again today. And so obviously when we received the November forecast, one of the big sort of increases in state expenditures was in education and special education. And that's come down a little bit from those projections with forecasts we just received yesterday. And I wondered if you could maybe, if there's any light you could share from the department's perspective on what you're seeing in terms of not only the difference between November and February, but some of the drivers in that. And obviously, we're probably all hearing from schools about the cross-subsidy and increasing demands for special education services. But what could you share with us that the department's observing?
Madam Chair and members, you do have a handout that describes the changes between February and November, but I think the bigger changes occurred between end of session, which was actually based on last February's forecast, and in November. The end of session data we had was based on fiscal year 15 final reports from school districts with some preliminary information for fiscal 16. The November forecast, we had the final data for fiscal year 16, we saw a major increase in special education spending. In fiscal year 16, we had based the February forecast on a projected 4% annual increase in special ed expenditures per student. The actual increase in fiscal year 17 and fiscal year 16 was 7%. Based on that, we adjusted our long-term projected growth in special education expenditures up to about 5.2% based on a four-year average. What happened in the February forecast is we had near final data for fiscal 17. The final expenditure increase in 17 was more like 3.5%. And so we kind of are a little bit of a roller coaster here where we had expected that the increase in fiscal 17 would be less than the increase in fiscal 16. And some of the increase in fiscal 16 we think was due to the first year of implementation of the new special ed funding formula. Districts were aware that fiscal year 16 would become the base year for some later calculations. And so in some cases they made some spending decisions to add staff, add programs in fiscal 16 that they were going to be adding in the next couple of years anyway, because they knew it would benefit them in terms of their their funding being included in the base. So what happened is we had the larger increase in fiscal 16 and then a smaller increase in fiscal 17. And when the final data came in for fiscal 17, it was a little less than we anticipated. So we've slightly lowered our projected growth for special ed in the future from 5.2% to 4.9%. It's still quite a bit above the rate that we had anticipated back, you know, a year ago. What's driving that? It's kind of a perfect storm. If we looked at our trend line, what we're seeing is more students being educated in special education. We're seeing staffing ratios go down, so more staff per special education student. And we're also seeing some increases in the average compensation per staff person for a special education. So all three of those things are happening at the same time, and that's what's driving this increase.
Thank you. And I presume that when you talk about the increases, that is above and beyond the automatic sort of inflation adjustment that's made in special education each year?
Madam Chair and members, in the old special education funding formula, we had a statewide cap that was increased at 4.6% per year per ADM, and that was kind of the long-term growth factor for special education. And when the new formula was implemented in 2016, that 4.6% factor came off. We no longer have a statewide growth cap, and so the special education aid tends to increase at the rate of whatever the special ed cost is increasing. It's based on prior year data rather than current year data, so there is a lag in there. But we're seeing the formula much more dependent now on what happens with actual costs. So pre 2016, if special ed funding increased by 7% in 1 year, the aid would still go up by 4.6%, and we would just prorate. So under the old formula in the later years, like in 2015, we were prorating the regular aid at, I think, around 89%, and the excess cost aid was prorated, I want to say off the top of my head, like 60%. So we at the state level, we were protected from cost increases because we had that automatic 4.6% increase. At the district level, they didn't know until the end of the year how much they were going to be prorated. So now what's happened, we've kind of reversed that situation where now we're funding based on what the actual cost is in the district. We're essentially funding a percentage of that. We use some student data as well as cost data, and the student data is a little more stable than the cost data, so that keeps the total aid from growing quite so fast as the expenditures. But essentially, we've kind of returned to the old method that we used before we introduced the caps, where the funding is now just a lot more dependent on the actual cost. Now, we still have a factor in the formula that grows what we call the hold harmless at 4.6% a year. But for districts that are kind of in between the hold harmless and the growth cap, their funding is based on a percentage of their actual cost from the prior year.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that explanation and refresh. I know we did a whole hearing last year on the special ed formula and the changes, and still absorbing some of that.
Madam Chair, I know you had a handout that was kind of my explanation of the changes between February and November. I also have a similar one that I could share with you if you like for the explanation of what changed between end of session and November, and that goes into a lot more detail in terms of what the increases were in the number of children being served by disability and what changes we saw in the average staffing ratios. And I think that might also provide you some good information.
I think that would be very helpful, so we'd appreciate receiving that. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Do you have them with you?
I have my own copy with a bunch of notes on it, but I can...
Okay, so if you just send it to us, we'll get it distributed to the committee. Okay, I thought maybe you had a stack of them with you. So.
No.
All right. All right, very good. Questions for Dr. Melcher, specifically on special education, or I guess if you have other questions for him, you could ask those too. Thanks. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Melcher, I'm looking at this handout. under data used in forecasts, and I know you just went over that, but among the factors, of course, are the state special ed expenditures, the student count, et cetera. So which one of those, is it the expenditures that is the greatest amount then?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, yes, the expenditures are far and away the primary driver, and if you look on page two of that handout, you'll see that we've been projecting the cost based on a four-year average, and you can see we were roughly 4% increase in fiscal 14, but then the cost started growing more rapidly. So the four-year average was 5.1% in the November forecast, and now it's come to 4.9%. So, yeah, that's the primary cost driver. Now, we do have two different types of cost. We have the special ed program cost and the special transportation cost. And actually, we had a significant drop in the special ed program cost, but the special ed transportation cost actually increased.
You've got that table, too. And that's on
page three. At the top, you'll see that for fiscal 17 in November, we were assuming the cost would be $262.7 million, and it ended up being $266 million when we got the 17 data. So we had a drop in the salary cost. Well, not a drop, a slower growth than we had projected. But then the transportation portion grew more rapidly. But if you add the two together, there was a net decrease between November and February.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. Dr. Milcher, what all is involved in the transportation when a district has to estimate or calculate? What all has to be taken into consideration?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, the special education formula includes 100% funding for the actual cost of special transportation services and in the prior year. And so not every special education student requires special transportation. It's only those that require an aide to be on the bus or a wheelchair lift or something like that. So school districts keep track of what those added costs are for that special transportation, and it gets added into the funding based on the prior year data. And what happened was the cost grew more rapidly than we expected. I will add one more thing. We have, in addition to the students with disabilities, there is also included in the special education formula funding for other students that require special transportation, and that's primarily homeless students. So I think the legislature saw that transportation for homeless students where the district has to transport them greater distances was also pretty expensive, and so the special ed formula actually covers not only the cost of transportation for special ed students that require special transportation, but also homeless students who require transportation outside of their regular attendance area because of the move. And by far and away, the special ed part is much bigger than the other part, but that is part of the formula as well.
So, Madam Chair, one last question. Thank you. So, Dr. Milcher, in regard to open enrollment, I visited with the superintendent from Alexandria yesterday, and they waive their open enrollment date. Mm-hmm. And what they receive in the open enrollment, and parents want these children immediately enrolled, is an influx of special education students. So how does that affect all of this?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, so the students had to come from somewhere, so I think what would happen if a school district gets an influx of special education students, well, first of all, they're going to receive, if they have to hire more special ed staff, they're going to receive some additional special education aid to cover a portion of the cost for those students. But if there's a one-year lag because it's based on second prior year data, our state law requires the resident district to pay 90% of the unfunded cost. So let's say you had a whole lot of open enrollment students move into Alexandria in 1 year, and that Alexandria had to hire some additional special ed staff. Well, they would get no additional special ed funding the first year to cover that. So they would, in effect, bill the resident district for the whole cost of that service. So the resident district would be paying a bill. Now, the resident district may be, you know, if the kids were being educated in their district the year before, they may be getting special ed aid in the current year based on last year's special ed teachers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who's to say whether the district that lost kids from special ed lost enough kids so they could have fewer special ed staff? Mm-hmm. But it gets a little complicated when you think about the one-year lag in that in that process. But let's say the kid's been open enrolled now in Alexandria for a year or two. The state's going to pay roughly 60% of the cost to Alexandria to cover the cost of that teacher's salary. They're going to bill the resident district for 90% of the difference, so roughly 36% of the cost. And the Alexandria district is going to eat 4% of the cost, that 10% of what's not funded, in their cross-subsidy. So it costs the Alexandria district a little bit, but not very much. It mostly goes back to the resident district.
Thank you for that explanation. But I think the waiving would cause planning problems, but that's their decision.
It would be more of a planning problem issue at the district level, yes. And that's why the legislature says, I think both districts have to agree, or the district.
Yes, you're right. They have to agree. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Other questions for Dr. Melcher? All right. Not seeing any others. Much. Thank you so much. We really appreciate you being here. All right. Any other questions for the department or nonpartisan staff on the forecast and the information today? Yeah, I'm not seeing any. I think we're done for today. So thank you very much, members. Committee is adjourned.